Chapter 3. His eyes, a monster with a pair of drumsticks, espanyol a devil's tattoo on his forehead, and a pair of imps are nailing great tenpenny nails into his hands to make his happiness complete. The late Mr. Clark's excellent work, Three Courses and a Dessert, was published at a time when the rage for comic stories was not so great as it since has been, and Messrs. Clark and Cruikshank only sold their hundreds where Messrs. Dickens and Fizz dispose of their thousands. But if our recommendation can in any way influence the reader, we would enjoin him to have a copy of the Three Courses that contain some of the best designs of our artist, and some of the most amusing tales in our language. The invention of the pictures, for which Mr. Clark takes credit to himself, says a great deal for his wit and fancy. Can we, for instance, praise too highly the man who invented that wonderful oyster? Examine him well, his beard, his pearl, his little round stomach, and his sweet smile. Only oysters know how to smile in this way, cool, gentle, waggish, and yet inexpressibly innocent and winning. Dando himself must have allowed such an artless native to go free, and consigned him to the glassy, cool, translucent wave again. In writing upon such subjects as these with which we have been furnished, it can hardly be expected that we should follow any fixed plan and order. We must therefore take such advantage as we may, and seize upon our subject when and wherever we can lay hold of him. For Jews, sailors, Irishmen, Hessian boots, little boys, beadles, policemen, tall lifeguardsmen, charity children, pumps, dustmen, very short pantaloons, dandies in spectacles, and ladies with aquiline noses, remarkably taper waists, and wonderfully long ringlets, Mr. Cruikshank has a special predilection. The tribe of Israelites he has studied with amazing gusto. Witness the Jew in Mr. Ainsworth's Sack Shepherd, and the immortal Fagin of Liver Twist. Whereabouts lies the comic vis in these persons and things? Why should a beadle be comic, and his opposite a charity boy? Why should a tall lifeguardsman have something in him essentially absurd? Why are short breeches more ridiculous than long? What is there particularly jocose about a pump, and wherefore does a long nose always provoke the beholder to laughter? These points may be metaphysically elucidated by those who list. It is probable that Mr. Cruikshank could not give an accurate definition of that which is ridiculous in these objects, but his instinct has told him that fun lurks in them, and cold must be the heart that can pass by the pantaloons of his charity boys, the Hessian boots of his dandies, and the fantail hats of his dustmen, without respectful wonder. He has made a complete little gallery of dustmen. There is, in the first place, the professional dustman, who, having in the enthusiastic exercise of his delightful trade, laid hands upon property not strictly his own, is pursued, we presume, by the right owner, from whom he flies as fast as his crooked shanks will carry him. What a curious picture it is, the horrid rickety houses in some dingy suburb of London, the grinning cobbler, the smothered butcher, the very trees which are covered with dust. It is fine to look at the different expressions of the two interesting fugitives. The fiery charioteer who belabors the poor donkey has still a glance for his brother on foot, on whom punishment is about to descend. And not a little curious is it to think of the creative power of the man who has arranged this little tale of low life. How logically it is conducted, how cleverly each one of the accessories is made to contribute to the effect of the whole. What a deal of thought and humor has the artist expended on this little block of wood. A large picture might have been painted out of the very same materials, which Mr. Cruikshank, out of his wondrous fund of merriment and observation, can afford to throw away upon a drawing not 2 inches long. From the practical dustmen we pass to those purely poetical. There are three of them who rise on clouds of their own raising, the very genii of the sack and shovel. Is there no one to write a sonnet to these? And yet a whole poem was written about Peter Bell the Wagoner, a character by no means so poetic. And lastly, we have the dustman in love. The honest fellow, having seen a young beauty stepping out of a gin shop on a Sunday morning, is pressing eagerly his suit. Gin has furnished many subjects to Mr. Cruikshank, who labors in his own sound and hearty way to teach his countrymen the dangers of that drink. In the catchbook is a plate upon the subject, remarkable for fancy and beauty of design. It is called the Juggernaut, and represents a hideous moving palace, with a reeking still at the roof, and vast gin barrels for wheels, under which unhappy millions are crushed to death. An immense black cloud of desolation covers over the country through which the gin monster has passed, dimly looming through the darkness, whereof you see an agreeable prospect of gibbets with men dangling, burnt houses, and sea. The vast cloud comes sweeping on in the wake of this horrible body crusher, and you see, by way of contrast, a distant, smiling, sunshiny tract of old English country, where gin as yet is not known. The allegory is as good, as earnest, and as fanciful as one of John Bunyan's, and we have often fancied there was a similarity between the men. The render will examine the work called Why Sketchbook with not a little amusement, and may gather from it, as we fancy, a good deal of information regarding the character of the individual man, George Cruikshank. What points strike his eye as a painter, what move his anger or admiration as a moralist, what classes he seems most especially disposed to observe, and what to ridicule. There are quacks of all kinds, to whom he has a mortal hatred, quack dandies, who assume under his pencil, perhaps in his eye, the most grotesque appearance possible. Their hats grow larger, their legs infinitely more crooked and lean, the tassels of their canes swell out to a most preposterous size, the tails of their coats dwindle away, and finish where coattails generally begin. Let us lay a wager that Cruikshank, a man of the people, if ever there was one, heartily hates and despises these supercilious, swaggering young gentlemen, and his contempt is not a whit the less laudable, because there may be tant soit peu of prejudice in it. It is right and wholesome to scorn dandies, as Nelson said it was to hate Frenchmen, in which sentiment, as we have before said, George Cruikshank undoubtedly shares. In the Day in London, asterisk Monsieur the chef is instructing a kitchen maid how to compound some rascally French kickshaw, or the other a pretty scoundrel truly. With what an air he wears that nightcap of his, and shrugs his lank shoulders, and chatters, and ogles, and grins. They are all the same, these mounseers. There are other two fellows more blue, one is putting his dirty fingers into the saucepan. There are frogs cooking in it, no doubt, and just over some other dish of abomination, another dirty rascal is taking snuff. Never mind, the sauce won't be hurt by a few ingredients more or less. Three such fellows as these are not worth one Englishman, that's clear. There is one in the very midst of them, the great burly fellow with the beef. He could beat all three in 5 minutes. We cannot be certain that such was the process going on in Mr. Cruikshank's mind when he made the design, but some feelings of the sort were no doubt entertained by him. Asterisk the following lines ever fresh by the author of Edlam Hall, published years ago in the Globe and Traveller, are an excellent comment on several of the cuts from the Day in London. The poor man's sins are glaring. In the face of ghostly warning he is caught in the fact of an overt act, buying greens on Sunday morning. 2. He rich man's sins are hidden in the pomp of wealth and station, and escape the sight of the children of light, who are wise in their generation. 3. He rich man has a kitchen, and cooks to dress his dinner, the poor who would roast, to the bakers must post, and thus becomes a sinner. IV. He rich man's painted windows hide the concerts of the quality. The poor can but share a cracked fiddle in the air, which offends all sound morality. V. He rich man has a cellar, and a ready butler by him. The poor must steer for his pint of beer, where the saint can't choose but spy him. V. His rich man is invisible in the crowd of his gay society. But the poor man's delight is a sore in the sight, and a stench in the nose of piety. Against dandy footmen he is particularly severe. He hates idlers, pretenders, boasters, and punishes these fellows as best he may. Who does not recollect the famous picture, "What is taxes, Thomas? What is taxes indeed? Well may that vast, overfed, lounging flunky ask the question of his associate Thomas. And yet not well, for all that Thomas says in reply is, I don't know. Be I plashically, what a charming state of ignorance is yours. In the catchbook many footmen make their appearance. One is a huge fat Hercules of a Portman Square porter, who calmly surveys another poor fellow, a porter likewise, but out of livery, who comes staggering forward with a box, that Hercules might lift with his little finger. Will Hercules do so? Not he. The giant can carry nothing heavier than a cocked hat note on a silver tray, and his labors are to walk from his sentry box to the door, and from the door back to his sentry box, and to read the Sunday paper, and to poke the hall fire twice or thrice, and to make 5 meals a day. Such a fellow does crouching hate and scorn worse even than a Frenchman. The man's master, too, comes in for no small share of our artist's wrath. There is a company of them at church, who humbly designate themselves miserable sinners. Miserable sinners indeed. Oh, what floods of turtle soup, what tons of turbot and lobster sauce must have been sacrificed to make those sinners properly miserable. My lady with the ermine tippet and draggling feather, can we not see that she lives in Portland Place, and is the wife of an East India director? As he has been to the opera overnight, indeed her husband, on her right, with his fat hand dangling over the pew door, is at this minute thinking of Mademoiselle Leocadie, whom he saw behind the scenes, as he has been at the opera overnight, which with a trifle of supper afterwards a white and brown soup, a lobster salad, some woodcocks, and a little champagne sent her to bed quite comfortable. At 8:30 her maid brings her chocolate in bed, at 10 as he has fresh eggs and muffins, with, perhaps, a 100 of prawns for breakfast, and so can get over the day, and the sermon till lunchtime pretty well. What an odor of musk, and bergamot exhales from the pew, how it is wadded, and stuffed, and spangled over with brass nails. What hassocks are there for those who are not too fat to kneel? What a flustering and flapping of gilt prayer books, and what a pious whirring of Bible leaves one hears all over the church, as the doctor blandly gives out the text. To be miserable at this rate you must, at the very least, have 4,000 a year. And many persons are there so enamored of grief and sin, that they would willingly take the risk of the misery, to have a life interest in the consoles that accompany it. Quite careless about consequences, and skeptical as to the notion that a day is at hand when you must fulfill your share of the bargain. Our artist loves to joke at a soldier, in whose livery there appears to him to be something almost as ridiculous as in the uniform of the gentleman of the shoulder knot. Tall life guardsmen and fierce grenadiers figure in many of his designs, and almost always in a ridiculous way. Here again we have the honest popular English feeling which jeers at pomp or pretension of all kinds, and is especially jealous of all display of military authority. A recruit, ditto dressed, ditto irved up, as we see them in the sketchbook, are so many satires upon the army. Hodge with his ribbons flaunting in his hat, or with red coat and musket, drilled stiff and pompous, or at last, minus leg and arm, tottering about on crutches, does not fill our English artist with the enthusiasm that follows the soldier in every other part of Europe. Jongean, the conscript in France, is laughed at to be sure, but then it is because he is a bad soldier. When he comes to have a huge pair of mustachios, and the croix d'honneur to briller on his poitrin cicatrisée, Jongean becomes a member of a class that is more respected than any other in the French nation. The veteran soldier inspires our people with no such awe. We hold that democratic weapon the fist in much more honor than the saber and bayonet, and laugh at a man tricked out in scarlet and pipe clay. That regiment of heroes is arching to divine service, to the tune of the British grenadiers. There they march in state, and a pretty contempt our artist shows for all their gimcracks and trumpery. He has drawn a perfectly English scene. The little blackguard boys are playing pranks round about the men, and shouting, "Heads up, soldier, comma, eyes right, lobster," as little British urchins will do. Did one ever hear the like sentiments expressed in France? Shade of Napoleon, we insult you by asking the question. In England, however, see how different the case is. And designedly or undesignedly, the artist has opened to us a piece of his mind. In the crowd, the only person who admires the soldiers is the poor idiot, whose pocket a rogue is picking. There is another picture, in which the sentiment is much the same, only, as in the former drawing, we see Englishmen laughing at the troops of the line, here are Irishmen giggling at the militia. We have said that our artist has a great love for the drolleries of the Green Island. Would anyone doubt what was the country of the merry fellows depicted in his group of paddies? Loss me amid O'Rourke's, O'Toole's, the ragged royal race of Tara, or place me where Dick Martin rules the pathless wilds of Connemara. We know not if Mr. Cruikshank has ever had any such good luck as to see the Irish in Ireland itself, but he certainly has obtained a knowledge of their looks, as if the country had been all his life familiar to him. Could Mr. O'Connell himself desire anything more national than the scene of a drunken row, or could Father Matthew have a better text to preach upon? There is not a broken nose in the room that is not thoroughly Irish. We have then a couple of compositions treated in a graver manner, as characteristic to as the other. We call attention to the comical look of poor Teague, who has been pursued and beaten by the witch's stick, in order to point out also the singular neatness of the workmanship, and the pretty, fanciful little glimpse of landscape that the artist has introduced in the background. Mr. Cruikshank has a fine eye for such homely landscapes, and renders them with great delicacy and taste. Old villages, farmyards, groups of stacks, queer chimneys, churches, gable-ended cottages, Elizabethan mansion houses, and other old English scenes, he depicts with evident enthusiasm. Famous books in their day were Cruikshank's own Gilpin and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.